No, we're in it. We're in it. You feeling good? We're in it.
Good.
This is it. Dude, I saw you guys at the Basement East last year. How long? That feels like.
Was that like the pop-up show?
The pop-up show. You did the pop-up show, which was crazy. There were probably like 1,000 people who couldn't get in.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you guys got on top of your bus.
On top of the bus, that's
and
right.
Just, but I feel like you did that every day, right? Like you did that everywhere.
On some of them, that was the only time we did it on top of the bus. Some of them were just kind of like out in the parking lot.
Why'd you guys do those shows? Who, like, why was that a good use of your time? To do those shows.
I mean, it's just
for
fun.
400, it's just fun. That's why you go and do them.
Yeah, it's fun. You know, I mean, we were on tour with Kenny and, you know, playing these big stadiums. And we just thought, well, I mean, you know, when you're an opening band like that, you get an hour set if you're lucky, which has been really invaluable for us to be on that tour. But we have a lot of fans and we just wanted to play more. So we just thought, why not do these little pop-ups?
Yeah,
he starts showing up.
He starts showing up at the
shows. His whole crew would be so hungover the next day.
Is that funny when, like, because I remember that show, like, I've seen a million shows at the Basement East, and when I saw you guys at the Basement East, you had your racks of gear and your guitar boats, and you just, like, took over the Basement East. But that was probably every venue, right? Is that, do you guys need all that stuff to play a show, or do you get so comfortable with it that it's like, we
don't
have
need
it
but it's
bring
all
it.
Set up to move in and out as quickly as possible, so it actually kind of be a pain
to not use it. Because what do you have? You're like your ears rack. Yeah. That takes up a lot of space.
Everything. Like all the pedal boards and everything. So they have a plug and play system going. So it would be a bigger pain for our crew to be like, just give me a guitar and an amp. We've actually tried that. We were like, why do we need all this stuff? And they're like, it would actually be harder if on us. So we're like, okay.
When do you try that? On that tour or like doing
that?
Yeah,
when we started talking about doing them, you know, they have to, of course, work out all the logistics. We just spout out ideas and then someone else has to make them happen.
Yeah.
And so that's when we were like, we heard all the conversations around it going like, why don't we just grab a guitar and an amp?
Make it simple. Come on.
Like, it's not that simple.
It's not that simple. Once you get there, that's... Yeah. But you guys did that thing where... I think at the end of the show, you were like, that's Trevor, that's Matt. Like, we're Old Dominion. And I was standing with Sydney Foreman, who I was like, oh, it's so good. And she was like, oh, they've been doing that forever since you played the OG Basement. She said, what is that? Why do you do that? What's the thing that you say? Like,
so I introduce each member, and then I say whatever city we're in, and then I say we are Old Dominion. That happened. So when we named the band, we were here playing at this little bar that's no longer there called the Blue Bar over in Midtown. And we didn't have a name yet. And we were trying to come up with a name. That night we were setting up and, you know, there's probably 20 people that came to the show or whatever. But we were setting up and trying to figure out a name. And we wanted it to be tied to Virginia because a lot of us are from there or have ties. And so I said, you know, the only thing I can find that's not taken is Old Dominion.
Find where? Like online? Like,
we were trying to everything, you know, and everything that every idea I had was taken by some other. I can't even remember what they were, you know. Some terrible names. That's naming a band is terrible.
Hard naming anything is hard.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
So I said the only thing I can find that's not taken is Old Dominion. And everybody said, well, that sounds pretty cool to me. So that night I introduced everyone in the band at the end of the show, and I said, we are Old Dominion. It's the first time I introduced, and then every show from that point has just been...
That's yours.
That's what we do.
That's what
I say every single night.
Was that the same band now, minus...
Brad was not in it yet.
You had another guy.
Devin Malone is a guitar player here in town, a good friend of ours, and he was the original.
Yeah. So I've heard the story... The person who really brought you to town was Phil Vassar, and you met him through his sister. His sister got a hold of some of your songs and gave them to Phil.
Yeah, I was working in Lynchburg, Virginia, which is where he's from, his family's from. And his sister was coming into work where I worked that day. And everyone that I worked with knew what I was trying to do and knew about him, of course. And they were all like pumping it up like, hey, Phil Vassar's sister's coming in. So I gave her a CD and said, you know, if you like it, pass it on maybe to someone else that you might think would like it, you know.
AKA Phil. Yeah. Yeah. So, he gets a hold of the record and he sees some potential.
Yeah. I had another sister that was working with him here in town. And so I got a message from her saying, hey, why don't you come to Nashville and check it out? So I drove to Nashville and went to the Bluebird. And
how old were you? Like
24. And then after the Bluebird, his sister, we drove down Hillsborough Road, and I was talking about how beautiful all the houses were. And she said, well, one of those is Phil's, and we're going to go there right now. So we went to Phil's, hung out, had some wine, and just talked about music. And he was sort of like, man, you know, you're obviously not an amateur. If you want to do this, you kind of got to be here.
Yeah.
And that was in August, and I moved in October. So
he gives you this other piece of advice, though, I think, where he says, look, if you want to come here to be a rock star, don't come here.
Yeah, that was actually...
was that not Phil?
That was not Phil. That was actually Daryl Scott.
Daryl Scott gave you this advice.
Yeah.
What does he say? Daryl Scott says to you, if you want to come to Nashville to be a rock star, don't come here. Yeah. But if you want to come here to what? Become a great... To become better.
He said, if you want to come here and be surrounded by the best songwriters in the world and the best musicians in the world,
come
and learn...
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So you come with that mindset, but to me it seems like that's such a great line to be like, oh, what great advice. Of course, that's why I'm coming to Nashville.
Sure.
But come on, weren't you coming here to be a rock star? No. Like, no? How is that even possible?
Because I was coming here to be a songwriter.
And in the back of your mind, it really didn't seem like I have a shot or I want to try to become...
Of course I had dreams of that as a kid and, you know, I've been in bands and, you know... That's why I got into writing songs. But at that point in my life, I had hustled as much as I thought I could in Virginia, at least. I'd played every venue I could and had been in bands and everything. And I just really was so interested in the songwriting end of things that I thought, well, I can move there. I can learn and hopefully I can have a career where I'm at home and I can have, you know, that life, but I can go in and write songs every day and have a career making music, and never thought about trying to do what I'm doing right now. Once I moved here, it was just go to Nashville, learn how to write a better song, try to be a songwriter. That was it.
And was that a little bit because you just felt it was so unattainable, or did it feel like even though becoming a songwriter is... you know, hard enough as it is and incredibly noble, did it feel like that was as far as I was going to get? Cause there was no way like becoming a rock star is even harder. Like, is that,
I don't think so. No, I think it was just, that's where my interest lied at the moment.
Yeah.
Was just, I think I need to be better. You know, I came here and, you know, saw that round at the Bluebird and was like,
I'm not good enough.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got some work to do here, you know? So yeah, that was it. It wasn't about anything being harder or anything. It's just where my interest was just, I was fascinated by the idea that you could make a living writing songs for other people to sing. It used to piss me off, honestly.
Which like, part?
When I first kind of started looking at Nashville, as you know, through those eyes, like as a musician, that was back when I was a teenager and I was all into like grunge and rock. And I started seeing all these songwriters back then. CMT used to, they would list the songwriter of the video. And I started seeing all of the same names and I started getting pissed. I started going like, why don't these artists write their own songs? I didn't understand that world yet. And then I started digging into it and digging into these songwriters and realizing what amazing artists they were in their own right. And people like Daryl Scott. And so then I started going, oh, wow, okay. Then I had less judgment for the artists and much more respect for the songwriters. And that was where I was drawn.
Because the judgment that you started to lose or that you started to gain for the artists, was that because you started to realize that they were just, you know, interpreting this great art, it just started to make sense.
Sure. You know, there's, and then I start to learn, you know, like you learn, like, you know, George Strait, the king.
Yeah.
He wasn't writing those songs.
Yeah. And now there was Frank Sinatra.
Right. And it didn't make me, I suddenly was like, oh, okay. that's a viable, of course that's something people do. I didn't, you know, I was so naive and thinking that, you know, everything was just so, you know, an artist in there like pouring his heart out and then ripping it out on stage for people, you know.
But you guys basically, I think there's like one song on this new album, Memory Lane, coming out that's like an outside cut.
Yeah, it's the only one we've ever done.
Only one. So basically you guys have written all, is that because you just, you feel like you have so many great writers in the band that we just don't need outside cuts, and does it make it a little more personal that all your songs are?
Yeah, I think there's part of me that still hangs on to that sort of ideal that, you know, I should be delivering, if I'm delivering the message, I want to make sure I'm delivering the message I want to deliver. And as a songwriter, it is the ultimate like reward to be able to stand there in, on the stage and just be that person. There's no middleman. It doesn't get watered down. What we say is 100% what we meant to say. Yeah. So it's pretty great.
How important are opening lines in your song? I feel like Old Dominion songs, some of them have incredible opening lines that just hook you right away.
When you get a good one.
Wait. I wrote down a couple of my favorites. These are a couple of my favorite opening lines in Old Dominion song. It was down some street we couldn't even pronounce. We were smoking a little from a half an ounce. Hotel Key. Everyone knows that song. Do you know that's a great opening line? Like, does someone come up with that line and go, that's starting the song? Yeah, like, what is that?
That happens a lot, you know, when you're throwing out lines, because you don't typically write from top to bottom all the time.
Yeah.
But there are lots of lines and things getting thrown out, and then one will inevitably get thrown out, and you'll be like, oh, that's start a great the song. Start.
You know? Why is that a great start?
You want to set the scene. You want to set the tone. You want to grab the attention. Our goal in writing songs, which is not everyone's goal, but ours at least, is to create a point of interest at various stages throughout the song. So starting with the verse, you want to grab them and then you want to keep them. So we got to find ways, whether it be lyrically or melodically or instrumentally, we just got to throw as many hooks as we possibly can in there just to make sure there's no dead space.
Yeah. So do you remember when someone threw that line out and you said, oh, we should open the song? Or is it hard to remember where that came in?
I don't remember that one.
Like when you come up with a line with, you could be the captain of whatever floats your boat.
Yeah.
Is that like, that's such a great line too. Like, and then you go, that's on the opening line of that song. But does someone say, then you're like, oh my God, that's genius.
Yeah.
Like,
that's, you know, I mean, you just get so excited in those sessions when you're throwing out stuff. It's a lot of laughing and a lot of excitement and joy. I mean, you know, like the first line I do remember. Was on No Such Thing as a Broken Heart, where I said, you know, I wonder if Jack and Diane ever made it after the drums and the guitar.
I know that's such a great line too, right?
And I don't know where that came from. That was a day that we were writing. We had zero ideas. And it was actually the Pulse nightclub shooting that had just happened in Florida. And it was the day after that. And we were all just kind of sitting on the bus somewhere, wherever we were in America, talking about it. And we had no ideas that felt right to write that day. And we just started talking about that and how we're supposed to handle stuff like that with our kids and how we're supposed to deal with it and process it. And so we started writing to this groove that Jesse Fraser had, and that line came out of nowhere. I don't know where it came from. I just spit it out and everyone went, okay, that's the beginning of the song. And that one we did write from top to bottom, that first line.
Yeah. I think that, like, I can picture if there's someone new in Nashville, like you were, and you went to the Bluebird and you heard these songwriters who made you go, oh, I don't have it yet, or I need to really work. I feel like some of your opening lines and songs would have that effect on me if I was a songwriter.
Yeah.
I would hear some of them and I'd be like, oh, I need to get to that level.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Like, it's,
I hope so.
You hope so, right?
Yeah.
But I just think, like, you guys, especially, maybe I'm overthinking it, but I feel like compared to so many other songs that I love, like Old Dominion always has these opening lines that are always like, pull you in.
Yeah. We try to make sure there's that every line is that.
It's great.
Yeah. We try to make sure there's no throwaway in there. So hopefully, and I always tell people, you know, in situations like that, like with me at the Bluebird or if you were sitting there, I always tell people, you know, you move here and you see this talent, you can either be intimidated by it and use that as inspiration to get better, or you can be intimidated by it and go home. And neither one is a wrong choice.
Yeah.
You know, like they're both understandable, you know?
Yeah. Right. Right. Do you think that you're an underrated guitar player? I feel like in Old Dominion, no one's hiding in that band. Even when Trevor plays acoustic,
yeah,
it's cranked in the mix. It's not like he's in the background playing acoustic.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You, like his acoustic is driving the song.
Sure.
And I feel like when every time I've seen you guys live, like, I know, like, you know, Brad's covering a lot of ground, but I feel you're playing a lot of guitar too.
I'm playing a lot of guitar. I'm a decent guitar player. I'm like, you know, like I can hold my own in some situations. I'm never going to be at a Brad level. You know, Brad is one of the best guitar players I've ever
seen. Why is Brad so great? Because, you know, he's not the flashiest
guitar
player.
He can be.
I bet he could be.
Yeah.
But his rhythm playing is phenomenal. Like, he sounds like the record when he's playing live. Yeah, like, he's unbelievable, right?
I think he's great. I mean, and that's a challenge for me a lot of times, because in the studio, you know, he's such a great guitar player. Yeah. Such a lot of great
ideas.
He
would probably be a great session player.
So we just, you know, lots of times it's like, you do it, man. You cover it, but then I got to learn the parts that he played.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So he makes me better just by having to sit down and figure out how he did it.
Like, what are some examples of parts that he came up with that can you remember?
Man, just
like,
listen to the records, because most of anything that I'm playing, you probably don't hear much of what I'm playing. You more so feel it, just because I'll probably just play a little one note little thing or big open chords that are supporting the whole thing. Anything melodic is him. He's and I think that's what makes him so great, is he's a songwriter too, and he knows how to play the right thing that serves the song. He doesn't have to be flashy. He's going to pick the melody over the flashiness.
Anything else, yeah.
Anytime, yeah.
Yeah. I always love seeing you with that telly, that sparkle telly that you play. Is that the best guitar for what you do on stage with
guitar.
Old Dominion?
Yeah,
what is that? So is that a custom shop?
It's like a custom shop telly that I just bought at Guitar Center back when I didn't have the money to buy it.
Yeah.
But I somehow scraped it together and thought, like, look, if I'm going to be out there doing this, I got to have a good tool, because I had just crap up until that point. So I spent way too much money on it. I think at that point it was like $3,000, which I did not have. And I love it so much.
Why is that the perfect guitar for what you do in Old Dominion? Is the telly the right sound?
I think
to do what you do.
Gosh, probably not, you know. But
probably,
though, you know. But
like
it might be.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I've just loved the way a telly feels. I grew up. I'm a Springsteen fan, and
yeah,
so that's what I idolized. I watched a guy just ripping it on a telly, and you know, Eddie Vedder also, I'm a big Pearl Jam guy. He also plays a lot of
telly. He always plays a telly and, right?
Yeah. So that's just what
I
was.
So it's not even really
to.
Like, because it's so many country artists play the telly. It's
no,
more like,
it's just, that's what felt right to me.
Yeah.
It felt good in my hands. And I loved that kind of like bright crunchiness, kind of almost shrillness to it that, you know, that comes out of it that you can't really get from anything else. So
yeah,
I play a couple other things throughout the set too that, you know, where a telly is not maybe the right choice, but needs to.
What do you play at the opening of the set? I was watching some videos. You're playing like a hollow body kind of thing.
Yeah, that's a Gibson.
What is that? That's just a Gibson.
That's
a
Gibson 339.
Yeah,
that was free.
See, this is the, you save all this money, and then when you have the money to buy the guitars, they give them to you for free.
You know,
right?
It's funny. It's like back then, when I got that guitar, I still didn't have it to buy. I needed the free guitar at that point, so it was really great that it came along. And then I had a we were playing at Sturgis, and I had a pinstriping artist paint a feather on it. So that's
what's on it. That looks great.
Yeah,
that's what makes it cool when you start personalizing the guitars and
And then I found the like twin guitar to the red telly. In blue, I found the exact same
like
guitar.
A sparkle blue, so kind of relic.
It's exactly the same thing except blue.
And you bring it out with you as like a
backup.
That's
the like B-rig.
The B-rig.
Yeah.
I love seeing you with that guitar. It feels like it's like a signature
it's
thing.
I'm most comfortable holding it. Yeah.
It looks like you when you're playing
for sure,
that
guitar. It's definitely become a thing.
Yeah. The red sparkle is a thing. Do you ever look back and do you just think like there were probably so many points where you could have given up and, you know, maybe not focused as much on the band or maybe even gone home as a songwriter? And do you ever say like, thank God I didn't give up because not, I wouldn't be doing it now.
Oh,
like,
absolutely.
How grateful are you for your younger self?
Yeah.
For pushing through to get where you are now.
You got to be grateful for the determination and for the stupidity really, to keep going.
Is that,
it's a little combination of both of, and just of, you get so far into it too, that you're like, well, what else am I going to do?
What is the other? Yeah.
I've gone this far. I got to keep going. There's enough of a little dangle in front of you to keep you going. Especially now, I'm so grateful for where we are and, you know, this platform that we have and the fans that we have and what a amazing spot we're in right now
to be able to do it. Like, this is a random analogy, but I was listening to some interviews with Daniel Ek recently, the founder of Spotify, and he said, if I knew how hard it was going to be to start Spotify, I wouldn't have done it.
Right.
Would you, if you knew how hard it was going to be to get here when you were starting out, do you think you would have still done it? Or would it have been discouraging?
I mean, probably not.
Really? You think if someone said it's going to take this many years, you're going to have to work this hard and you're 24.
Well, I take that back because I think people did tell us that, and people did tell me that, and I did tell myself that. I remember even, the reason I remember that I was 24 was I was sitting at the kitchen table when I was telling my parents that I was moving to Nashville, and I was still only, you hear the term 10-year town, and I was like, if it takes me 10 years, I'll still only be 34 years old.
Yeah.
And
that didn't seem scary, you being 34 when you were 24. That probably,
it didn't really
seem
scary to me. I've never really hung on to the age thing too much, but yeah, it just felt like the right move. But people tell you all along the way that, this is going to be, this is a long road, it's going to be hard, but the benefits that come from it, the joy that comes from it and the fulfillment that comes from it too, is you have to have that part of it. Because if you don't, you won't keep going.
Yeah.
So, I remember also, we were about to have the number one party for Break Up With Him. And I had a bunch of family in town, and we were riding down 16th. And there was, an article in the newspaper about it. And my uncle was like, man, Matt, did you ever think this would happen? And I said, yeah, I had to.
Yeah.
Or else I would have quit. I had to believe it would have happened, or else why am I here? So you have to hold on to that a little bit.
Was there anyone that started after you guys started and blew up before you guys blew up? And then you go, oh my God.
There's tons of people that do that. There's tons of artists that have rocketed past us, but we have always been good with our pace. We've always said, look, the temptation is to chase after what other people are doing and what you think, listeners want to hear. But for us, it's always been, don't chase after that. Let's just make the music that we believe in and that we like, and we will turn around one day and look at this amazing body of work. And, as long as we're slowly and steadily rising, stay the course.
See, I believe you when you say that, because you sound like, you seem like a pretty laid back guy. And it's not like, I, when you say that, I really believe it. But at the same time, I feel like that's something that's easy to say. But when success is moving slowly.
Yeah.
That's
the word. You have to keep telling yourself that. It's not that you're completely confident in it all the time. But, and you might slip now and then. And, a song might slip through here and there where you're like, we were chasing after something there.
Yeah.
We shouldn't have done that. We should have, you have reminders along the way.
But who's reminding you? Yeah. Internally, you're just reminding yourself.
Internally, and we have, that's the benefit of being in a true band. There's five of us, and we're not just out here alone. One guy might be like, guys, I really believe in this song. And the rest of us are going, man, that's what everyone else is doing right now. Yes, it sounds like a hit song. It's maybe not what we're doing. So we have the five of us to keep each other grounded. And, somebody's ego gets too big, we pull them down.
Yeah.
Or if somebody's down, we pull them up. So that's the benefit.
Isn't that crazy how so few bands are in country music? Do you ever think about that? And do you ever think, why are
bums
not
me
more?
Out?
It bums you out?
Yeah.
Wait, why? Because like...
It confuses me because I feel like, you know, that's what everyone I know growing up, you know, that's what we wanted. It's collaboration. You be in a band and you create this music. And I know that there's plenty of people that move here that had that same upbringing. I don't know why it doesn't ever translate into a band. Like, how come you don't move here and form a band? Like, it is hard, but it's shocking to me that there's not more. It's weird.
And do you ever see people where you go, oh my God, like, you're an incredible guitar player, but you'll never be an artist because maybe you can't sing?
Maybe. We don't really think about that. I don't really think about that, but it's, you know, there's definitely times where we're sitting around. We were talking about it not long ago, just like, maybe there's a way we can help other bands. Like, there has to be a way to like help people come together. There should be more. This should be.
How would you do that? That could be a great idea.
I don't know yet.
Like, what does that even look like?
I know. I don't know yet, but hopefully there's an avenue there that we can actually facilitate other people working together, because, you know, you never want to be a manufactured band. Like, that's not what we're talking about. There should be people that are drawn to each other creatively, you know, that make a run for it. And that's what happened with us. And, you know, no one put us together. So I wouldn't want to be like, great guitar player, great bass player, great drummer, you guys
maybe
get
that
together.
Would work though. Maybe that would get maybe it done.
But then it would have to, you know, and that could work initially. But then you just have to let it go.
And see if it gels.
Instead
or
of
works.
Record this song, wear this, do this, you know. So, I don't know. Hopefully there's a way that we can help. And I have to, like, hope, too, that maybe there's some people out there that see what we're doing and we're helping in that way, that go like, oh, they did this. Maybe we can, too.
Yeah.
So hopefully there's
that's the one thing there. Like, it's fun to see Bruce and little Steve like interact
right
with each other, or to see Eddie Vedder interact with Mike McCready. Like, it's fun to see that energy on stage. And when it's a solo country artist, sometimes they'll interact with the band, but it doesn't feel the same, right?
Yeah, it's like a little lonely.
It's a little lonely out there, right?
Yeah. It's like, and who do you, you know, you also get surrounded by, you know, teams of people whose job it is to facilitate what you want. And so whether that be a bad idea or a good idea, you know, so you get surrounded by yes men. And when you're a solo artist, there's no one there going, dude, what are you doing?
Just at your level.
It's a terrible idea.
To really ground you. Yeah.
So we have that benefit.
Yeah. But that's really part of the fun too, is you go out with everyone and you guys are, you're still all on the same bus, right? So you go out and everyone's hanging and like, and, you know, that's what's fun about being in the band. You hang out with everyone.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know,
I always wanted to be in a band.
It's so much fun. I mean, we laugh constantly. It's all, you know, when you're in your bunk on that bus and you hear someone laughing in the morning, you better get up, because you might miss a like inside joke that's going to last for
five
a decade.
Years, for a decade. Is that how you feel? Does that happen?
Yes.
You're like, holy shit.
If you hear
shit,
people laughing, everybody gets up. Like, what? What's going on?
I'm laughing too. That was so funny. I'm in on that. You just have to feel included, totally. Right, with the band.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I got to get into a band. How do I get into a band? Fun, sign me up into the Old Dominion Band Camp. The band program.
It's
oh
so
my
fun.
God. The new album's coming out next week. Yeah. As of the time of this recording, Memory Lane, this is the fourth album?
Fifth.
This is the fifth album.
Yeah.
What is it hard? Because when you're starting, it's like a blank slate. Maybe you're trying to prove something. Every idea is a new idea. By the time you get to the fifth album, does it start to be like, are we repeating ourselves? Like, we have to start finding new ways to, new messaging, new songs to sing. Like, to me, I feel like it would get hard.
You would think, but right now, oddly, we are extremely relaxed and comfortable, and I think that's coming through in this album, because I don't think we felt any pressure really at all. We wanted to, we knew we had a goal in mind, which was, you know, coming out of COVID was tough, and we'd made sort of a more artsy album with Time, Tequila, and Therapy,
yeah,
which is an amazing process, and something.
So you guys all went to where? West Virginia?
Asheville, North Carolina.
Asheville, North Carolina, excuse me.
And we wrote and recorded it all there.
Yeah.
And that was so cool. And so, but we wanted to, like, we, objectively, we were just like, okay, let's buckle down. We're going to make some hits. We're going to, you know, make some big music. And that was it. So we knew we were capable of it. We're confident in that. And so we just started writing as much as we could and digging through old songs as much as we could. And it was a very open communication process between the five of us. And it was really an awesome experience.
Are there songs on this album that is an older song that you wrote years ago that you found and you said, oh, that would be a great song?
A couple of them are. Well, Ain't Gotta Worry in the World was one that we wrote kind of in the same trip as like One Man Band was. So that one has been hanging around for a while. And Different About You is one that's been hanging around for a number of years, probably 5 or 6 years, that we've looked at before and then passed and then looked at it again and then passed. And then for whatever reason, this was the right moment.
Do you just feel like it fit with this group of songs?
We got into it. Like, for me personally, I wasn't a huge fan of the demo of that song. It was a little light for me. And a couple of the guys were like, man, but the song is really cool. And so they convinced me, like, okay, let's just, why not? What's the harm? Let's give it a shot. But then Brad starts playing some Red Hot Chili Peppers, Jimi Hendrix thing. And then we're like, okay, you were right. You're right. It was time. So
how many songs did you end up recording for this album that didn't make the cut, that didn't get, that you decide?
I don't know if we recorded anything that didn't make the
everything
cut.
That you guys record is on. It's like 18 songs. Right?
Yeah. I think the only one that came close was, there's a song on there called Sleep Without Drinking. And we recorded that once and we missed. And in the past, I think we would have just been like, yep, that doesn't make it.
What do you mean missed?
We didn't achieve what we wanted to achieve.
Like sonically.
The recording was bad.
Yeah.
Like, we just didn't, our performance wasn't great. We weren't nailing it. It was just kind of like, eh. And in the past, I think we would have just moved on. But for whatever reason, we all felt like we should try that again. So months later, we tried again.
On the early records, I think the production credit, if you look, it says produced by Shane McAnally.
Yeah.
And then later it says produced by Old Dominion and Shane McAnally.
Right.
Is that because did you guys become a little more confident in your production ability?
Yeah.
And then you had more say in what was happening in the studio?
Yeah. Like, in the beginning, you know, Shane was involved way before, you know, the band became a thing, because we were just writing songs together. And, you know, he was just as starving as we were back then. And we would go in to make demos of the songs that we had been writing. And he had such a strong voice in the studio making those demos that when it came time to record, you know, we had this idea to record as a band and we were trying to figure out if we wanted a producer because we didn't know what we were doing. We were like, man, Shane is always so good when we make demos. Why don't he knows us, and he's probably written half the songs with us. Yeah. Why don't we bring him in to see if he can help us?
And is he also a great producer? Because he's a great songwriter.
Incredible.
What makes him a great producer?
His instincts are just immediate and usually right. You know, he just knows immediately if it's right or wrong. When we play the pass or whatever, we will feel good, and he'll be like, no. Do it again. That wasn't good. Or most times he's the guy going, I promise you it's better than you think. Come in here and listen to it. And then we go into the control room and he plays it for us. And he's, you know, he's right. He's the encourager to keep us going and help us figure it out. And then as time went by, we did get more comfortable with who we are as players and our ideas of what directions we wanted to go, that it just became way more collaborative, you know, process.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
So this record too, song out right now, Can't Break Up Now with Meg Maroney.
Yeah.
That has a great opening line also. You know, the color of my coffee, too many shirts in my closet. that you bought me.
Yeah.
Do you know that's a great line when you write that? Why is that a great line? Because it's just
weird enough.
It's just weird enough
that
you're like, but I've never even thought about that you would know someone so intimately that you would know how they take the color of their coffee.
You know, because even if you do take coffee with cream, there is a certain amount of cream that people like. Some people like it very milky. Some people like just a little. And if that's a very intimate thing that people share about, you know, like if you're in a relationship for a certain amount of time, you start to learn these little idiosyncrasies. And that's one thing that like, we're like, man, that one statement says where these two people are.
Yeah. How'd you come up with that line? Do you even remember? Or
I don't. You know, that's another one that sort of like came out of nowhere. Trevor and I and Topher Brown and Emily Wiseband, and we were writing that day, and I'd never written with Topher or Emily, and I was excited, and we spent hours with nothing, and that at this point in our careers, all of us. That feels pretty deflating because we're like, man, really? We're going to get nothing today?
Like when you're writing it and you go, we're not getting anything.
Like how come this isn't working? We're four great songwriters. And
do you feel confident in your ability to come up with a great idea in the room on the
fly? Yeah, usually. Or I usually am trusting that it will come or someone else will. But it wasn't happening that day. And then for whatever reason, after about 3 hours of toiling away at nothing, that idea came to me, and I just
which idea
I like stopped what part of the idea? I stopped the writing and I said, is there a song called Can't Break Up Now? And everyone went, I don't think so. And I was like, the idea that you're so ingrained in each other's lives and the thought like this can't be happening to us right now seems like something we could explore. And everyone was like, yeah, that's
like, I got nothing better to do right now.
Forget this crap that we're writing right
there's
now.
There's nothing better. We'll do that.
Yeah.
Sure. And, no one was just fully sold on it.
And they then it just like, came. It was like, you know, probably 45 minutes later, we had the song.
Do you really get down on yourself when you're in the room? And it's, like, I would think when you write every single day, you can't expect every day.
You can't, but it still pisses you off.
Because you're like, oh, I should have some, or something should be, coming.
It's
me
just
right
a,
now.
You know, it doesn't really, I say it pisses you off. It doesn't really piss you off. It just bums you out. Of course, you want something. You want, and there's an inherent, like, insecurity, I think, amongst all songwriters that you're, at least the ones that I know the best, you're always afraid that might be the last one you ever wrote or the last good one you ever wrote. And you're just, so you're surprised when another good one happens. So when one doesn't happen, you're like, uh-oh, you know, is this it?
Because you know so many artists who write unbelievable, like the best songs in the world, and then all of a sudden their albums suck.
It's a window, you have a window of time here. And so you always feel that kind of breathing down your neck a little bit.
Yeah.
And you have a day that maybe you're not performing at your best and you can't come up with something cool. It starts to it starts to eat at you.
Do you feel that a little bit now? You guys are on your first arena tour, and I feel like when you start headlining arenas, you're kind of at a point where if you just look at the history of rock and roll and music, maybe in the very far away future, you start doing theaters, but you're still crushing theater. Like once you get to arenas, your place is so solidified.
Pretty good.
Do you feel that way, or do you still feel nervous? Like, oh my, like this could all go away, or like this. Like,
no, I feel like if it does go away, it's fine. Like we got to do some stuff that no one gets to do.
Yeah.
So if it did go away tomorrow, like I would be sad, but I would be proud, and you know, I would feel like, I mean, obviously there's more we want to do, but hey, I can't complain about what we've done. So. Yeah, I think, and if we never had another hit song, we could tour for quite a long time.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it feels pretty good to be where we are.
Well, what else, like, what's the next, what else do you guys want to do?
The next one would be football stadiums. You know, we kind of came up with that mindset. I remember when we were looking at choosing managers, we were meeting with all of these different managers and walked into,
Morris Heim,
and we sat there and had a meeting with them, and you know, they showed us, you know, they were like, look, we have a roadmap of how to get from where you are to stadiums. And we've done it before. We know what to do. We think we can do that with you. And that was all it. You know, we
what
like,
is
okay.
the roadmap? Is it just the touring, supporting?
I think it is.
In front
yeah.
of the fans.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot of that. A lot of touring and just, I mean, you can't go anywhere without the songs. So
they
saw us and said, okay, they've got the songs. Like, we're not worried about that. So that's the hardest part. They got the songs. Let's figure out how to get them out there to people. So,
yeah.
So, yeah. And, you know, Kenny Chesney obviously was the model.
Yeah.
And so we spent 5 years on tour with him learning how to get there.
Yeah. Makes sense. Yeah. I was at Billy Joel when he played Nissan Stadium, and not to name drop, but I was with Brad and Roxy, our friends, and Brad, the band, obviously. And I said to Brad, Brad, is it crazy? Like, when you're here seeing Billy Joel, and you're probably one of the only people in this venue who's actually been on that stage and played Nissan. Like, is that weird? Like, or how do you feel? Like, you're the only one who's done it.
Yeah.
Do you feel that way? Like, now when you go see a show at Bridgestone Arena of Pearl Jam.
Right.
Like, probably there was a time where these guys felt like gods. And now you're like,
yeah, for sure.
Those guys are my peers. I've done that.
It is crazy.
That a bummer? Because now it's like these people are like so human now.
No.
And you realize like.
It's encouraging. You know? It's definitely. And there's a respect. I think, you know, I've never met Pearl Jam, but I think they would. You know, we might not be their favorite type of music, but I think they would hold respect for us, for what we've achieved too. And, you know, I did get to meet Bruce Springsteen, and he spoke to me like I was a peer, which blew my mind because he
is my... How do you meet Bruce Springsteen? Where do you go meet Bruce?
It was the only occasion that I have ever called Clint, our manager, and said, if there are any strings that you can pull, please pull them now. And I went to see his show on Broadway.
Oh, yeah.
And we were playing a private show in the Hamptons, and I bought a ticket to his Broadway show just by myself. I didn't want to tell anybody I was going because I wanted to go by myself because that's how much his music means to me. I didn't want anyone
there. Someone next to you being like talking to you or saying, it's like, shut up. I just want to listen.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I went into the city and, you know, I told him this is what I was doing and said, if there's any strings you can pull, please do. And he said, okay, I'll see what I can do. And he reached out and I wound up with his tour manager's phone number. And we were talking and he said, you know, it's up to Bruce, you know, but let me know when you're here at the theater and he might want to meet you before or he might want to meet you after. But the chances are, because it's a Saturday night, he usually just gets off stage into his car and he goes home. So don't get your hopes up. So I was like, okay. So I showed up about 2 hours early and I was like, I'm here. And
how were you pitched to him? Like Clint said,
you know, I don't know. He probably just said, you know, this is my artist and he's a huge, huge fan.
Yeah. You know? So you get there 2 hours early.
Yeah. Which, you know, and he said, okay, let me talk to Bruce. And he says, okay, Bruce says, there's a couple other people that he wants to pull backstage, after the show. So we'll come get you after the show. And so I'm sitting there and,
like, crap, now I got 2 hours in Times Square. Yeah. What am I going to do?
I'm just like sitting in this empty seat, you know, and I'm waiting. And
you get recognized.
It's a great seat. Well, yeah. The funny thing was I'm sitting there and the seats next to me are empty. And these two guys come down the aisle and they sit next to me and they look familiar and they're like talking. And I'm like, who is this? And then I hear the guy right next to me's voice. And I said, oh, shit, that's Adam Duritz from Counting Crows.
Yeah.
And the other guy was Chris Carrabba from Dashboard Confession.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And I was like, wow. And, you know, Counting Crows were another huge influence on me. So I'm like, man, I got to wait for my opportunity to introduce myself to him. And so we're sitting there, and he's in his conversation. I'm waiting for a lull. And the lull comes and I turn to him and he turns to me and he goes, "You're Matt from Old Dominion, aren't you?"
No way.
I was like, "Oh my
no
God.
Way. That's yeah. what he said?" Yeah. And what'd you say?
I was like, "Yes, I am. I'm a huge fan." You know, we hit it, and we're both huge Springsteen fans, and we just geeked out. And we're both sitting there, you know, crying during the show. And
oh my God.
And get to go backstage. And
so he was one of the people that you all went back with.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So oh my cool. God. That was yeah. a great show.
This unbelievable.
And have you seen him on this run?
I haven't seen on this tour yet. No.
I saw him in at UBS Arena.
Oh yeah.
When he played there. Wow. And he played for, it was incredible.
Yeah. I've seen him probably, I don't know, six times or so.
It's the best.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. That's such a great story.
Yeah. But when I met him, you know, he was just,
yeah, like, well, yeah, we're, yeah, what was that?
We're
like
talking shop, you know, he's like, what's, how's tour going? And you know,
do you feel like an imposter when you're hanging with Bruce? Do
well,
you go,
sure.
You're like, I'm like faking this. Like, yeah. I'm not, this is,
I'm not really,
this, doing, this you're, like, yeah. you're really doing this. I'm like yeah. a joke. Like this
I'm
is
a hack
nothing,
over here. Right. Can I get a selfie? You know,
do you like, feel that way a little bit? Or do you have the confidence where you're like really,
it's, you know, a little bit of both. I think I also know enough to know that most artists in,
feel that way.
In that,
yeah,
you know, in this realm feel that way.
But is Bruce magical to me? Because I feel like he's a pretty laid back guy.
Yeah, he's great, man.
He's just like, he's
everything
like,
you'd want him to be. You know, yeah. They say don't meet your heroes, but that was pretty great.
That was it.
Yeah.
I love it. Memory Lane's coming out.
Yeah.
Singles already on number one. That's a good start for the album.
Yeah, that's a good start.
great start for the album right there. Was that always the single? Who picks that? That is the single.
I mean, we always, it's always a spirited discussion.
Yeah.
That involves a lot of people. You know, we always have our kind of internal debates about it. And then our management team has their feelings about it. And then the label has their feelings about it, and we usually just get into the we get into a room with all of them, and we don't leave until we all agree.
Yeah.
So, you know, the label likes to show us all kinds of graphs and charts and shit, but it's useful information, and you know, it's tough for us all to land on the same page every time, but ultimately we all decided, okay, Memory Lane seems like the leader.
And then does White Smoke come out of Morris Hyam?
Yeah.
When you pick. And,
exactly. And then I go to throw up because I'm so nervous about, you know,
about
what the choice is.
About what the choice is. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, but that makes sense. That's, but then don't you feel like, okay, like we've done everything we can to pick this single. Is there a song on this album that was written like One Man Band? You guys wrote One Man Band like moments before going on stage, right?
Yeah.
Like in the wings of the arena.
Yeah.
You were like, I can't even picture this. You're about to go on and you're backstage.
Yeah.
And you go, hey, hang on, hold on, hold on.
Intro music.
Everybody stop for one second.
Yeah, yeah.
There's 10,000 people out there. I've got an idea. Hold on. And you start like recording this idea really quickly, like into your phone.
Yep. We were all huddled around a phone. Intro music is playing and we were singing that song into the phone.
Into the phone. And then you wrote it after like in a locker room.
Yeah. Pittsburgh Steelers.
In Pittsburgh Steelers. Any stories like that with songs?
No.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Denver Broncos arena.
You wrote it in the locker room and that's where it came together.
Yep.
Basically, any stories with songs on this album where you wrote them, you know, moments before walking back, you know,
nothing
walking
crazy.
To meet Bruce Springsteen.
No. Like, nothing crazy on this one.
This was all written where writers like,
some of them were written, in the studio at the time.
Yeah.
When we were recording, like I Should Have Married You was one that just came out in the studio. Well, actually, I did. We had a day off in Canada a few years back, and I had taken some edibles and was feeling a little loosey goosey and created that. I'm not a piano player, but I created that piano part for I Should Have Married You and that drum loop and held on to that for a couple years. And then we were in the studio, and I plugged my laptop in and played it for him. And then we wrote I Should Have Married You to that.
That's so, a great song too.
Yeah.
What is that about? You write that and does your wife go?
Right. I mean,
does your wife come
it was
to
just
you
a,
and say,
yeah, no.
Well, what, do you want to
I mean,
talk
you know,
about
what
this?
It's what about. We're storytellers, you know, as well. And, you know, it's our job to sort of be observant and, you know, speak about the human condition and, you know, what people may be going through. And there's plenty of people out there that feel that.
Yeah.
You know, that little twinge of,
I love
regret.
That song. That song's out right now. You guys did a smart thing where you put basically half the record out.
Yeah.
So you said, we're not going to give you.
We just wanted
songs.
We just wanted more music out more often.
Yeah.
So when we would get a batch done, we knew the album wasn't done. Whatever. Just put it out. Let's just keep going. So we just gradually built it.
I love it. Memory Lane, the album, 18 songs. And you guys are on the road right now. Yes. The No Bad Vibes tour.
Yeah.
It's happening. You've played a bunch of dates, but if you miss them, that's on you. And then they might be coming to check the schedule because they might be coming to you.
Yeah.
Where are you going this weekend?
This weekend we're in, let's see, we are in Charleston, South Carolina, and I think Raleigh and Charlotte this weekend.
Something interesting about you guys, early on, some of your biggest markets were Boston, Chicago.
They were in like Minneapolis was a big one.
Yeah.
Crazy. Right?
But is that weird? Because most of the time, Boston's a big country market. New York, like I grew up in New York. We never got, like the tours would announce and they would hit every market.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't hit New York. It's still kind of like
for a long time, there was no country station there.
Yeah, right.
It was a shock to us. We thought like, this is odd. All of these like big metropolitan areas are the ones.
How were they finding your music at the time? Was it on the radio then, or
you know, yeah, and on Sirius XM, I think was a big supporter in the beginning, and you know, I mean, that's sort of how we kind of backed into this whole thing because, you know, Break Up With Them was being played on the highway, and then randomly, this never happens, but there was a guy in Seattle that started playing it on the radio, an unsigned band, and calling all his buddies, and they started playing it, and we started getting this traction with no radio team or anything. It just naturally, organically happened, and then finally, you know, Sony, who had turned us down, along with every other label, called and was like, actually,
come back.
Yeah.
But isn't it funny that you guys were signed out of New York?
Yeah.
And then they called Nashville and said,
You're signing these.
And I bet they would, I bet that's hilarious to think about now because now it feels like you guys are in the Sony Nashville roster. Like, it's crazy to think of you guys being anywhere else, but that's what happened.
Yeah. Yeah. They didn't see it until New York saw it and said, sorry, guys.
And then did you ever work with the New York office or? Quickly a little bit, Sony Nashville kind
of. Yeah, a little bit, but it was interesting. I mean, and we have a good relationship with Julie Swidler there in New York, and she's kind of was a champion for signing us. But then it was interesting because shortly after that, they had fired the president of Nashville, and so we made our entire first album with no one. At the helm.
Looking over you.
No one.
Yeah.
No one A&R'd it. No one did anything.
Who approved the title? No one.
Yeah. I mean, at that point, finally.
That's how Me and Candy was made under those circumstances. Like, no one was overseeing it.
No one was there. And, you know, Julie in New York was helping. And then finally, Randy came in. Randy Owen came in. Not Randy Owen. Randy Goodman came in. And, you know, at that point, we had picked the title Meat and Candy. And I remember some people at the label like kind of went to him and were like, you got to stop these guys. They're trying to name their album Meat and Candy. And he said, I don't care what they name it. If it's got hits on it, I don't care what they call it. It's their album. So
don't you think he could have easily said, put out whatever music you want, but come on guys, pick a different
For sure.
title.
Like, for sure. But they've been great at like, that's, you know, sometimes they will say that.
Yeah.
I think they've.
Who said that on Happy Endings? On that
title? He said the same thing, you know, and the great thing about that one, he was with us when we picked that title. We were on a boat in Key West and we had a bunch of radio people, program directors and stuff out on this boat and we were playing them previews of the album and we didn't have a name for it yet. And there was a song called So You Go. And we started talking about whether or not it was a happy ending or not. It was like, does this song have a happy ending or not? We can't tell. And it was like, everybody just kept saying happy ending, happy ending, happy ending, happy ending. And we all laughed and we were like, I think we should call the album Happy Endings. And everyone on the boat like cheered. You know, all these radio people, we were like, hey, if you guys think it's cool, we'll do it. And they all went, yes. And so we got off the boat and I looked at Randy and said, I think we just named it. And he goes, again, I don't care what it is named.
Don't care. And at that point, you can't say, oh, but all these radio people aren't going to like it. I'm worried about that.
Exactly. They were there for it.
They loved it. It's all numb if they don't play the record. Happy endings. Great title, too. Memory Lane, though, very safe.
Yes.
Very safe title.
Very safe title.
As safe as it
comes. We went self-titled.
Like, and again, care if there's a hit song on it. That's what, that's what we care about. Matt, thank you so much for taking the time. In between the road, I know you're home and you know you probably just want to not be working right now. But
all good, man.
So appreciate you coming in. New records coming out. Memory Lane, 18 new old, less. There's half that because a lot of this is already out.
Right.
So you got to listen to this when it comes out.
Yep.
I got the link. I was listening to it. This is like a, this is an unbelievable Old Dominion record.
Thank
this,
you,
if you're an Old Dominion fan, this is going to be what you want to hear. I mean, this is, this is all of it.
Appreciate
and they're on the road. They're playing. They're playing arenas. Headlining for the first time.
Yep.
None of this hour-long set BS. Then Kenny's got to come on. No, this is. You're coming out to see your favorite band, Old Dominion. That's what you're gonna get.
Yeah.
Who's opening with you on you guys right now?
It's a whole bunch of different people. Yeah, yeah.
It's
depending on the market. So we've had like Priscilla Block on some of it. We've had Tyler Hubbard's on some of it. Nico Moon's out with us right now. So it's completely changing depending on the market.
Yeah. What advice do you give to someone to support act? You hang out with them afterwards and
you don't hang out too much because at that point I'm pretty exhausted.
Yeah.
And I just want to go to bed after, you know, I just want to have my little drink and go to bed. But I think the advice would be, you know, learn what you can from us.
From us. Look at how great we are.
Well, mostly also learn what not to do. You know, there's certainly will be things that we do that aren't right for them. And that's just as important. You know, to observe. So you just have to, I would just say, just watch, you know, like we went out and we still go out and watch Kenny's show. And there's so much you can learn from just watching what an artist does with their fans. And, you know, our fans are different than Kenny's fans. They cross, you know, they cross over for sure. But our relationship is unique, and I think an opening band for us will have the same experience. Just watch what we do with our fans, and then you can learn how to foster your own relationship with them.
Yeah, great advice. Now you guys have like a huge thrust on like a catwalk
that
splits off into two other catwalks into like a
so
T shape.
Yeah.
Do you coordinate what to do with that, or you just make it up? And
it just kind of naturally happens.
Yeah.
Just kind of like, I think I fall into patterns for sure. That's probably helpful for, you know, the camera guys and the spotlight guys, but which are actually our truck drivers. But so it's probably helpful for them that I just kind of fall into a natural habit.
This is so in the weeds, but this is my last question. You do there's microphone stands all over the catwalks, right? And everywhere. So then you take the microphone off a stand and you'll walk around and then you'll put it on a microphone stand. So basically it's just stands without microphones.
Right.
Versus each stand having its own microphone, then you take the mic, walk down, you're screwed, you have nowhere to put it. That is, somebody thought about this, right?
Well, it's because I have to play.
You have to play guitar.
I have to play. I need a place to put the mic so that I can keep playing.
So is it stressful to be a frontman who also plays guitar?
No, it's fun. I would rather do that, you know. And there's plenty of songs that I don't, but it's nice. It's a nice, you know, it's a good feeling to be up there. You feel like a rock star when you're up there playing guitar. And
yeah,
singing.
You feel like Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love it. Matt Ramsey on the podcast, Old Dominion. Of course, everyone knows about this. You got to go see him live. Everyone knows what's going on. Nobody's waking up to this right now. They know. They know
might
what's
be.
Happening.
They might be. Yeah.
They know what's going on. The new record's coming out. And we love it, man. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We'll do it again.
Yeah. Awesome.
I love it. Matt, thank you.
Yep,
we're out.
You.
Woo.